Spirit of our oceans, you of salt water, composed in such a way that you are made up of an infinite number of tears. Know that we human beings have cried out in our times of need. The tears have flowed. We have created rivers of tears from our sorrow. But you welcome us, O ocean. No river is refused. Wherever we come from, whoever we are, whatever we carry, we find in our world places that will hold us, that will offer us the balm of water that heals, that will take us into places and possibilities that we have never known. Let us never forget that the ocean indeed refuses no river.
The Salt Doll. A doll of salt, after a long pilgrimage on dry land, came to the sea and discovered something she had never seen and could not possibly understand. She stood on firm ground, a solid little doll of salt, and saw there was another ground that was mobile, insecure, noisy, strange, and unknown. She asked the sea, "But what are you?" It replied, "I am the sea." And the doll said, "I cannot understand, but I want to. How can I?" And the sea answered, "Touch me." So the doll shyly put a foot forwards and touched the water, and she gained the impression that the sea was beginning to be knowable. She withdrew her leg, looked down, and saw that her toe had gone. She was afraid and said, "Oh, but where is my toe? What have you done to me?" And the sea said, "You have given something in order to understand." Gradually, the water took away small bits of the doll's salt, and the doll went further and further into the sea. At every moment, she had a sense of understanding more and more, and yet of not being able to say what the sea was. As she went deeper and deeper, she dissolved more and more, repeating, "But what is the sea?" At last, a wave dissolved the rest of her, and the doll said, "It is I." She had discovered what the sea was, but not yet what the water was. The doll knew what the sea was when she became, minute as she was, the vastness of the sea.
Melting into the far-off horizon, the azure sea was tranquil that day. But as the boat left the dock, I reminded myself that we precarious travelers who stood on the boat's deck were at mercy of the ocean's power. Further we got from shore, cradled by the force of titanic waves, the all-consuming self-importance of my land personhood began to be subsumed by the knowledge that I was part of a larger universe. My boat companions that day didn't initially have similar thoughts, for their troubles were great. Eight of them, after all, had lost their father, and along with a collection of their children and grandchildren were now headed out to sea, and their plan was to cast his ashes into the ocean and say goodbye. As a minister for hire, for a funeral home who had sold more burial at sea packages than they could handle, I was to officiate the service for this fractured family. Now, as we left the shore, I spoke with a woman of around 60, one of the daughters of this deceased man. The family split years ago after Dad came out, and then he and my mom got divorced. she said quietly. It was ugly. Most of us haven't spoken to the other side in decades. The funny thing is that everybody made up with Dad, but we're still not speaking to each other. That's the way things go in families sometimes, right? She stopped scanning the mostly silent figures who stood on the deck of the boat. Dad knew he didn't have much time left, but I can't imagine why he bought this burial at sea package. I never even knew him to give a thought to the ocean. They must have given him some sales pitch. I thought. His warring family, trapped for 3 hours on a boat, with nothing to do but talk to each other. I think her father knew exactly what he was doing. And why would someone want to be buried at sea? She asked me, not rhetorically, but in full expectation that I would give her a response. I gazed at the water all around us and considered what she said. Why, indeed, the ocean? So I've been trained in theology, obviously, and the study of answering life's big questions is something I take near and dear to my heart. So I found myself in that moment turning to the concept of religious naturalism, a way of meaning-making that incorporates the realities of our natural world and existence into understanding life's complexities, even if our ultimate understanding is that there are no real answers. Religious naturalist David Ray Griffin says, "If only the world of nature is real, then anything presumed to be outside of nature is often considered not real. God, heaven, hell, etc. Further, if all causes are natural causes, there are no miracles or divine interventions. Indeed, for many theists and atheists alike," Griffin says, "if naturalism is correct, then theism is incorrect. Science and religion, given this perspective, are irreconcilable." However, ideas that resolve this conflict are as old as science, and one way of describing religious naturalism is any religious position that reconciles with science. So I like this idea that he puts forth, that a religiously naturalistic position is one that reconciles itself with science. For that day on that boat with that family, so small we were on that vast ocean, but so large was their pain, as great as the ocean itself. And what happened out there on the water, as I'll explain in a few moments, was religious. Religious in its capacity to transform. Religious in its probing of the mysteries of the macro, the universe itself with the planets and the sun and the stars and great oceans, and micro in its touching of the human psyche and the wounds of the human heart. Now, most of the time, I'm less concerned with what religion is or isn't, and more concerned that all people, wherever they come from, whoever they are, however they identify, that all people have the opportunity to experience what religion at its best can evoke. The sense of connection to others and the universe we live in, the emotional resonance of knowing that one's personal needs are not the end-all and be-all of a purposeful life, and the capacity to find spiritual healing. Religious naturalism connects the religious impulse to the scientific realities of the universe. In this framework, we cannot have a religious experience if we do not have nature itself. That's why we touched upon caring for our oceans in our Time for All Ages segment this morning. Healthy religious experience requires us to be in healthy relationship with nature, with the realities of the world, not set away from it or above it or beyond it. Now, in Unitarian Universalism, we most commonly express this idea by talking about our seventh principle, the interdependent web of all existence. We engage in environmentalism not just because it's the right thing to do, but because without responsibly honoring that web of existence, there is no faith, no meaning, and no purpose. And so there I was, on that boat that day, with 20-some people who hadn't spoken to each other in decades. With a box of ashes, we were soon going to be leaving at the bottom of the ocean. and with a question from a daughter who couldn't understand her father's wishes. Why be buried at sea? Fortunately, the captain made an announcement about snacks, so I had a little time to think right after she asked the question. We'll be sailing for another 45 minutes or so, he said, so sit back, relax, and enjoy the day. Clearly, he hadn't seen the frozen expressions on the faces of that estranged family or heard their deafening silence against the sounds of the sea. Father Richard Rohr writes, if we don't find a way to transform our pain, we will always transmit it to those around us or turn it against ourselves. If your religion is not teaching you how to recognize, hold, and transform suffering, it is junk religion. A religiously naturalistic perspective is hard to hold as a religious framework while also subscribing to junk religion. Any clear-eyed view of nature will see that suffering is all around us. Just as Yom Kippur encourages examining and taking responsibility for asking for forgiveness, for forgiving, for actively engaging the cycle of repentance, so too are the realities of life's pain inextricably woven into nature's cloth. And so to be a religious naturalist requires one to face the pain of this cycle's inevitabilities. You can think of the ocean, with its turning of the tides, its movement across the shores, the life that teems within its depth, sometimes gloriously free and sometimes brutal in its predatory nature. You can think of the ocean as a manifestation of the cycle of life itself. So large and great it is, so powerful, and yet we float across its surface, knowing all the while it is a sleeping giant that can awe us with tsunami force. Forget the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita and the Quran for the moment. Today the ocean is our sacred text. Poet Jay Wolin says, when I walk in the ocean, I feel the waves rush across my feet. And I feel a certain peace with the world. I take in a breath, and I know I am in the present moment. All of these wonders that move us and make us feel alive and make us dream and make us wonder, let us protect them so that my children, our children, everyone's children, we'll also have the chance to look beyond the horizon and marvel at the wonder of existence and continue to be nourished by our home, the earth. Unitarian Universalist minister Erica Hewitt says, when I'm around people in pain, sometimes the energy of their sadness rolls over me like an invisible wave. If I remain passive, its force can knock me down. Pain is going to visit all of us. You, me, the guy on the subway, sporadically but unrelentingly as long as life lasts. Ultimately, I believe there's one thing as common and as powerful as pain. Our capacity to be companions to each other, both our genetic material and our holy spark, compel us to reach for one another. As partners in hope and fellow meaning makers, to help one another transform pain into something holdable. I think that's what began to happen that day on that burial at sea experience as those estranged family members stood in their pain on the decks of the boat, pain at losing one who they loved, pain at being at odds with each other. Like that great invisible ocean wave Erica Hewitt speaks of, the people on that boat, me included, felt that sadness roll over us and something had to be done. And something was done. As we got further out to sea, these silent semi-strangers began to talk. Not necessarily about those long ago issues that had driven them apart, but about the man they were saying goodbye to that day.
about the ocean around us,
about the school of porpoises that swam alongside us for a while, the sunlight glinting off the oily sheen of their skin, about their father's choice to be buried at sea. And then at last, it was my turn. Some might ask, I said as we stood with the box of ashes at the bow of the boat, why someone might want to be buried at sea. The daughter nodded. At last, I was answering her question, reading from the notes I had scribbled as we had traveled across the blue water. Throughout our lives, I said, we human beings cast things into the sea. We might, as children, put notes into bottles and let the waves take them. We might cast fishing lines into the water or even cast ourselves, overcoming our fear of the unknown as we learn to swim in the ocean's mysterious depths. Likewise, we cast our deepest reflections into the waters, wondering at the vastness of the universe, our place in it, the sea of life so large and our boat so small. How are we to know or understand the mystery of our presence here? Yet we sail on. Life emerged from the earth's oceans. We emerged. Though we walk on land, we remain part of the sea, and the sea remains a part of us. We are bound to the sea by evolution, by experience, by love, by loss. So we cast these remains out today. We cast them out upon the sea, a way of demonstrating we're not separate from the sea, that we remember we are joined to the sea and all it contains. When we cast these ashes into the sea today, let us also leave behind the sting of old wounds, the pain of our sadness. The sea won't carry it all away, but instead will give it a new home, a home we are connected to, one that carries at least some of the burden for us. This morning, we continue our annual tradition of acknowledging the pain, the wounds we all carry in our lives at some point or another. Some have come to this sanctuary this morning feeling raw pain, pain that feels the sting of salt. And perhaps for some others here, pain is something of a distant memory. The thing to know and understand is that whatever our relationship with our own wounding, our own pain, sooner or later we will find ourselves on that boat at sea, just like that family did, sitting there fully in your own pain with nothing to do but to face it. Now, I'd love to tell you that this boat trip healed everything for this family, but I'm sure it didn't. But for a moment, they banded together to lay their father and grandfather and great-grandfather to rest. For a moment, they thought about his relationship to the sea, to the universe, to the miracle of life itself. For a moment, they thought about their own relationship to those big questions. And in the minutes when we cast his ashes into the sea, they too were invited to share some of their ashes, their pain, with the sea. And I will say that their faces were different on the journey back to shore, not completely transformed, not fully healed, but at least touched by the experience of being together in that way, at least a bit more aware of the scale of their human struggles in the far-reaching possibilities of the universe. So on the table before me, we have water that all of you brought for our water communion last week, from all the diverse experiences and places you have
brought that together and shared it in a communal bowl. And there's also a bowl there of salt. Salt that symbolizes the sting of pain and hurt when our open wounds are touched by it. Yet, like water, salt is a vital part of life, of course. And mixed with the water, this communal water that we have created together, the salt becomes like the water from the sea, which invites us to sail on its waves. And so in a moment, if you would like, I'm going to invite you to please come forward and just add a pinch of salt to the water, silently. It can mean what it needs to mean for you. But that salt can be the wound, the hurt, the pain you've experienced, the loss you might still feel keenly, the relationship that still haunts you. And I invite you to give a little bit of the sting of those wounds back to the sea. We will all still carry those wounds when we leave here today. There's no magic here. But in embodying this action, we remind ourselves of our place in nature itself, of the healing power offered by the possibilities of this earth. We felt the sting of our wounds, and we've released a little bit of that back into the water. We hold each other's pain and acknowledge that our work as a community involves healing both our own and others' wounds. We cannot do that work out there in the world if we ourselves are not whole. Today we've created a little ocean out of our own tears, our pain, our connection, and our hope. Remember, nothing we do is ever done completely alone. We are part of the great ocean, part of our great planet, part of the great universe, and part of each other.